beginning of the 90s, where he was dropping cold atoms through two slits, two material slits. And then by a multi-channel plate, they were detecting the position where the atoms were falling, and then they could observe the interference fringes. In most of the experiments that are done nowadays, the splitting and the recombining of the different parts of the wave packet is done using laser radiation. One of the common methods is based on a two-photon transition in a Raman configuration, as it is shown here, to transfer momentum to the atoms. And you can, through the coherent interaction of the light with the atoms, you can adjust the interaction to have what is called a pi over two pulse, that essentially, if the atom starts in a state A, after this first interaction, it is in a superposition of state A and state B with the transfer of momentum from the light to the atom. So this pi over two pulse essentially plays the role of a beam splitter. And then you can adjust again the intensity and duration of the interaction to have a pi pulse that essentially inverts the internal state of the atom and also changes the momentum. And then another pi over two pulse can play the role of a recombiner. So as I said, you reproduce what is usually known for optical interferometers. But in this case, it is, one could say, a matter wave, which is propagating rather than an electromagnetic wave. So this can be done with this configuration. And as I will show, this can work as a gyroscope or in this collinear configuration where the atoms are flying in an atomic fountain. And this can be used as a gravimeter to measure gravity. In fact, this is the case which is shown here, where the atoms are flying on their parabolic flight. And during the flight, there are these three pulses that I described before that split, reflect, and recombine the two parts. And then at the output, as I said, you can observe an interference pattern, as these are all the interference fringes that we observed in our lab. And the effect of gravity in this case is to shift the interference pattern. And the phase is simply described by this expression. K is the wave vector of the light used for this Raman transition. T is the time between the interaction, and G is gravity acceleration. So if you measure this quantity and you know the others, then you can extract the value of the of gravity acceleration. And what is interesting is that if you use numbers which are quite realistic in the lab, like 150 milliseconds for the interaction, the separation between the pulses, and the signal to noise of 1000, then you see that potential sensitivity of this gravimeter is the order of 10 to the minus 9 G per shot. So for every launch of atom fall like everything else. So every second, essentially, you can measure gravity acceleration with precision of 1 part per billion. This was already demonstrated in the 90s by the group of Stephen Chu. Was published in this paper. And you see here with this fountain of cesium atoms and this Raman interferometry scheme that I just described, they could measure gravity with a precision close to the one that I showed to you. And with that, they could observe the tidal effects and compare it with the models. So this works essentially very well as a gravimeter. Essentially the best gravimeter that you can build now. It is not the only case, and I will show you that, for example, in our lab, we showed that using a rather different effect, which is block oscillations for the atoms in an optical lattice, again, you can use the atoms to measure gravity. These kind of systems were used in different configurations. For example, again in the group of Markashevich here, they were combining two gravimeters to realize a gravity gradiometer. And also in this case, the performances can be quite impressive because you reduce the common mode noise. Other groups like CIRT in France have developed transportable gravimeters, for example, used in this case for a watt balance experiment. This is a system developed in Berkeley by the group of Holger Müller. You see here, this is a 1.5 meter high fountain, so larger than the others. And then this system can be even larger, as this is a 10 meter fountain that was developed in Stanford and I guess will be described in more detail in the next talk by Jason Hogan. As I said, the systems can also work as gyroscopes. One of the systems was already demonstrated as one of the first atom interferometers in 1991, using, in this case, calcium atoms in this kind of configuration for the interferometer. And a more sensitive gyroscope was developed at Yale by the group of Markashevich. You see the kind of sensitivity they could achieve. And this is the one built at CIRT with a more compact configuration. And in fact, in terms of a compact system, it is interesting that now these atom interferometers are already kind of practical sensors. In fact, this is a system that is developed at Stanford for navigation applications and survey. I don't know, it's not, maybe Jason can say more about that, but so except for the applications, this is clearly a sensor that can measure gravity gradients, rotation, linear acceleration, and as far as I know, it can be operated on a helicopter. So it's really a practical sensor. So we are not developing this kind of systems, but in Europe, there is quite some effort to try and get a space mission where, for example, an atom interferometer could be operated together with an atomic clock to test general relativity. Okay, so this is the end, I would say, of the short introduction to atom interferometry. And now I would like to describe to you some experiments that we have performed using atom interferometers. The first one is a precision measurement of the of big G, the Newtonian gravitational constant. Why do you want to measure big G? As you probably know, after the historical measurement by Cavendish in 1798, there have been about 300 experiments to measure this fundamental quantity, fundamental constant. But this is a case in physics in which experiments done by different laboratories give results which are not consistent with each other, sometimes by a large amount. So the first idea is that there are systematic effects which are not under control. And one issue is the fact that most of the experiments have been done still a la Cavendish, so using macroscopic objects and measuring the force between these objects. And it was found, in fact, that, for example, there are systematics that can be due, for example, to the fiber in the torsion, to dislocation in the material of the fiber in the torsion balance. But even the most recent results, even if each of them quote a precision of parts in 10 to the 5, then the disagreement is by a few parts in 10 to the 4. So the situation is that this is not under control. And so the idea of our experiment, which is the acronym MAGIA, that in Italian is accurate measurement of big G by atom interferometry, is to use a method which is completely different to try and identify these systematic errors. And the idea is to use atoms, as I showed to you as a gravity sensor to have some well-characterized source masses, measure the effect, the gravitational field produced by these source masses, and by from that extract the value of the gravitational constant. And also you can use a similar scheme to test the validity of Newtonian law, that is the 1 over r squared dependence of the force. When I first proposed this experiment in 2001, the codata value had a relative uncertainty of parts in 10 to the 3, 1.5 parts in 10 to the 3. As you see here, this experiment took more than 10 years. So this is interesting to show how difficult this experiment. This is a typical time for a BG experiment. And in the meanwhile, the uncertainty of the codata value was improved by one order of magnitude. I wouldn't say improved, was reduced by one order of magnitude. Okay, so why do you want to use atoms for this experiment? There are a few reasons. First of all, an atomic sensor can be extremely small. You know, the expression for the gravitational force is quite simple. Essentially, you want to know the mass distribution, so masses and distances. So if you have at least one of the two, which is very small, the problem can be somehow simplified. So this is one point. The other is that atoms, as we heard for clocks, have well-known and reproducible properties, and you can do precision measurements. And also, it's somehow interesting that you are using some quantum probe to investigate gravity. So this should be discussed in more detail, but still, in general, I think it's quite interesting. And of course, you have the freedom to choose the right atom to try and be as immune as possible to stray field effects, and you have the freedom to use different states, isotopes, to again to try and control possible systematics. This is the basic idea of our apparatus. We have a fountain of rubidium atoms. In order to subtract the change in the gravity acceleration, we have a gravity gradiometer. So essentially, we have two clouds of atoms, which are interrogated simultaneously. And then we have two sets of masses, essentially 500 kilograms of tungsten, that can be moved in different positions. So that by moving the source masses, we modulate the relevant effect. If you put numbers, as I said, you can say the sensitivity can be as high as 10 to minus 9 G per shot. 500 kilograms of tungsten at a few centimeter distance give you a change in gravity acceleration of about 1 part in 10 to the 7. And then you see that for each launch, you get a precision, in general sense, of the order of 1 part in 10 to the 2. So if you integrate over a few hours, you can get to 1 part in 10 to the 4, which was the aim of this experiment. So, Magia apparatus. If you take the origin, the paper by Cavendish, he was writing at the beginning that the apparatus is very simple. I must say that our apparatus is not at all simple. Probably it's the most complex apparatus ever used for this experiment. And this is just a small list of, you know, all the lasers, electronics, vacuum, again, electronics, and then, so it's rather complex apparatus. Here are a few parts. This is a picture of the atomic fountain with the tungsten source masses. And this is the table with all the laser systems. We have a lot of optics. This is the vacuum system for the fountain. And this is a closer view of the tungsten cylinders playing the role of the source mass. This is an animation that was just done by a student of mine to show. Yeah, as I said, we want two clouds of atoms that we interrogate simultaneously. To have the two at the right time and with enough number of atoms, we use a juggling system. So we trap some atoms in a magneto-optical trap, then we launch them with a moving molasses. And then while they're flying, we trap another one, we launch that one, we retrap the first, and we launch the second. So essentially, this is at some point to have the atoms in a certain place, not certain, in the right place that we want. And then we detect the atoms at the output of the interferometer, the two clouds. And with that, we can describe, by plotting the signal from one interferometer versus the other, we get a Lissajou pattern, because we have two sinusoidal figures. And so as a function of the source mass position, we can measure, what we do is to measure the change in the this Lissajou pattern, and this is our signal. These are the first results that were published by our group and by Mark Kasevich group with, let's say, proof of principle results. Here you see, you can see a change in the ellipse shape, but compared to what I will show later, you will see that the signal was still marginal. We published a better results in 2008. Here you can see clearly now the change in shape due to the different position of the source mass. And since then, we have been working essentially to get to a real value for a real precision measurement of Big G. And this required an improvement in sensitivity, in the accuracy, and a better refining of the data analysis procedure. So to improve the sensitivity, we had to increase the number of atoms. I'm not going into many details, but if instead I can... So improve the number of atoms, improve the detection by reducing the detection noise, improve the contrast, removing the thermal atoms with a better velocity selection, and then stabilizing many experimental parameters. And then an important point was the compensation of the Coriolis effect due to the rotation of the Earth. Here you can see how the sensitivity of the the atom interferometer improved in time since 2007 to 2013. And as you see, the sensitivity of each of the two gravimeters, if you take them a single gravimeter, is very close now to the limit sensitivity that I was telling you before. So this means that, and here you can see the beauty of these ellipses now, the very high signal to noise and contrast. So this means that now to get to a value of Big G with an uncertainty of 1 part in 10 to the 4, you just have to integrate for about 100 hours. Of course, this is in terms of sensitivity, but the problem here is systematics. So we spent quite some time in identifying and controlling the systematics, like the precise characterization of the source mass, the characterization of the atomic trajectories, the calibration of the detection efficiency, and then we used a trick reversing the direction of the momentum transferred by the light to the atoms to cancel some common mode effects. Quite some work was done on the source mass, which was for us maybe a little bit boring. It's not that we are atomic physicists, but we spent quite some time in understanding how this tungsten is inside, because this is a trivial issue but can give you a wrong number. So you can have a perfect apparatus, but if your source mass is, has holes in it, then your number would be wrong. And we found that this material that was used also in some previous experiments had some non-negligible inhomogeneities inside. And so with the company that is producing this sinterized tungsten, we developed a method which is called hot isostatic pressing that then proved by different tests to reduce the inhomogeneities at a level which is completely negligible at the level of precision we want to get. And also we had to develop a technology to build a system to position this 500 kilogram of tungsten with the micrometric precision. So all of this was done. The high density of tungsten is also important because the gradient produced by this mass is high enough to compensate the Earth gravity gradient, so that this reduces the sensitivity in the positioning of the atoms during the measurement. The positioning of the atoms, the trajectory of the atoms, was quite a crucial aspect that we had to investigate, and we used different methods to characterize very precisely the position and the velocity of the atoms in the cold atom cloud. As I said, we used this method of the momentum reversal to cancel some of the systematics. And finally, essentially, 1 year ago, in July 2013, we could record this data. And essentially, we stopped when we had a relative uncertainty, statistical uncertainty of about 100 ppm. These are the data. The data analysis went through the calculation of the phase for a given gravitational potential, and then we use a Monte Carlo simulation of the atomic cloud to take into account the spatial distribution and the velocity distribution of the atoms. And then this was also used to compute the uncertainty on the different parameters, the dependence on the different parameters. This is the error budget for our measurement of BG. You see here that the main contribution is still given by the atomic cloud size due to the residual velocity, which is extremely small, but because the atoms are microkelvin temperature, they are velocity selected, but still the velocity is not zero. And this is the number we got after this more than 10 years of work. Okay, this is the number. The uncertainty is 150 ppm, and I must say, happy to say that this will be published tomorrow in Nature. So there is still 1 day of embargo, but we are there now. Okay, looking at the number, it's not so easy to guess where we are. So I think it can be interesting to see this table. Here you see some of the recent measurements. This is the co-data value when we started the experiment, as I said, with a parting 10 to the 3 uncertainty. So in blue, you see the co-data values. And this is where we, the value that we found, essentially. And so this is considered relatively interesting because it's the first measurement which is done in a way which is completely new compared to the others. Then the question is how many standard deviations are significant, but somehow you can guess on which side we are.
Some points with small error bars.
In fact, this is something which is, true. When I designed the experiment, I decided not to push too much on the possible precision. I mean, as you are seeing and as you will see in next talk, the atom interferometer sensitivity can be, I wouldn't say as high as you want, but you can get very high precision. And for example, I could have put the masses closer to the atoms, so the signal would have been higher. So what I'm saying is that it would have been relatively easy to get error bars as small as this. But then you see that, in my opinion, it doesn't make so much sense, because this is just a demonstration that most of these results are not controlling their error budget. One of them probably will be right, but it's... So what I tried to do was to build an experiment that was reliable at that level in terms of accuracy. But in fact, your question is just what I was showing in the next slides. The results can probably be improved, but probably thinking of a different configuration. Because, as I said, we use masses that are not limiting us at this level, but at some point, the masses, not only for us, but also for other experiments, will be a limit. So probably you have to think of a different material and possibly going maybe silicon, you know, a perfect crystal.
There are very precise, yes. Rather number measurements.
Yeah.
Silicon crystal.
So that's what I'm saying. Probably the final measurement could be done with the atoms and silicon, so you would have a very simple probe and the perfect source mass. Perfect probe, in my opinion, means that you have also to think of a different atom for a series of reasons that I'm listing here. And at the moment, I think that a very good choice would be a strontium atom, because I will show you now in the second part of my talk that strontium is a promising atom for some characteristics for precision measurement. So I would say that is reasonable to say that a precision of 1 part in 10^5 could be reached by atom interferometry. And if you are optimistic and you have some very good idea, maybe you can go to parts in 10^6, but this is just to say that maybe it's possible. Okay, so I would like now to switch essentially to experiments we have done using strontium atoms. And this is somehow in the frame of an effort we have been doing to measure gravity at small spatial scale. I shouldn't give here the motivation because there are experts here. So studying gravity at small distances can be related to extra space-time dimensions, to new possible particles, and also, as Sundrum was discussing, to the small observed size of Einstein cosmological constant. For an experimentalist, it's clearly a big experimental challenge, because this is generally true that when you study gravity, you are studying something extremely weak without the possibility of shielding spurious effects. So this is always true. But when you go to small distances, small source mass, then you're really facing different difficult problems experimentally. And in fact, experiments have been done using, for example, torsion balance. These slides, just to say, I'm not sure this is updated, but the idea is what is shown here. And also using micro cantilevers. As I said, we developed systems using strontium atoms, and this was because we have developed strontium apparatus both for the interest in optical clocks, as we heard yesterday, and as I will show to you today, to use them as atomic sensors. And my interest for strontium goes back now to 20 years ago, because you can see here that in 1992 I was publishing what at that time was could be published as a high resolution result with a 6 MHz line width. And now after 20 years, we got 8 Hz. So it is my personal view of the advance we had in this field in 20 years, 6 orders of magnitude is quite impressive. And we put some effort on the possibility of building this as a transportable optical clock. And here you see the system that we developed in Florence in the frame of a European project funded by the European Space Agency, with the idea at some moment, at some time, to bring this optical clock in space, as I said, for tests of general relativity. So we heard about already about strontium. Strontium is interesting because you can optically cool the atoms to very low temperatures in a very fast way. And then you can take these cold atoms at a temperature of about 1 microkelvin, and you can load the atoms in a vertical optical lattice. So essentially, this green light is a retroreflected laser beam that produces a standing wave. And what we observed is that when you when the atoms are trapped in this optical lattice, when you release the atoms and you make a time of flight image, essentially, okay, some atoms fall down under the effect of gravity, but ones that are trapped perform these periodic oscillations, whose frequency is simply given by this expression, product of the mass, gravity, and the wavelength of the light producing the optical lattice divided by Planck constant. So again, you can see that here, if you measure precisely this oscillation frequency, you can measure gravity. And what is interesting is, in this case, is that while in the previous interferometer I was telling you for big G, the atoms are flying by several centimeters during the interrogation, here the atoms are confined in a few wells. So they can be confined in a few micrometers.
How many atoms do you have?
Sorry?
How many atoms do you have?
The number is of the order of 1 million atoms. And in fact, what we, the experiments I will show to you, like this one, we are loading several lattice sites. But in principle, you could define the system to load only a few sites. So it's, as I said, it's a probe that can be micrometric in size and potentially have a high sensitivity. The effect is not new. In fact, this is related to Bloch oscillations predicted by Bloch for electrons in a crystal under the effect of an electric field. But this had never been observed before in normal crystals because of the imperfections in a normal crystal that destroy this coherent effect. And in fact, this had been first observed by Christoph Salomon in 1996 with a similar configuration. But the difference in our experiment is that while in those experiments, this effect lasted only for a fraction of a second, using strontium, you see, we can observe these Bloch oscillations for several seconds. I will show to you later, we go up to 20 seconds. So this is a coherent quantum effect that goes on without being perturbed for tens of seconds. So this is interesting by itself, I think. But also, it is a good method since you can measure this frequency for a long time, then you can measure it very precisely. And as I said, this allows you to measure gravity with a relatively high precision. In these years, we have then been working, developing different methods to measure this Bloch frequency with high precision. I'm not going to go in detail, but essentially, the idea is that we modulate the optical lattice, and you can see that when we get to the Bloch frequency, this produces a coherent delocalization of the atoms in the optical lattice. And so by detecting this effect, essentially, we can measure the Bloch frequency. And we can work at higher harmonics of the Bloch frequency with the corresponding increase in sensitivity. The Bloch frequency in this case is about 500 Hertz. So we measure the signal at 500 Hertz. If you can work at the 10th harmonic, you measure a signal at 5 kilohertz, and then you reduce your potential uncertainty by one order of magnitude. As I said, this looked to me like the right system to measure gravity at small distances. I must say, at the beginning, I was thinking of a Raman interferometer near a surface to measure gravity at very small distances. But here, you would have problems of the size of the atomic beam. And so finally, this did not turn out in a real experiment. While using the Bloch oscillation, looked like the right configuration where you can use the retroreflecting mirror, combining the retroreflecting mirror for the Bloch oscillations, using it also as the source mass with a proper shield for the Casimir effect. So essentially, the experiment is to bring the atoms near the source mass that also plays the role of the mirror producing the optical lattice.
How far away is that mirror?
Sorry?
Separation?
From the source mass?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is shown in the next slide I will show to you.
Shield
means, so we had a coating of gold. So essentially for the aim of this experiment would have been looking for gravity effects at small distances. So we had a sandwich of materials of different density. And then we had a coating of gold covering. So shield means making the Casimir effect equal, independent on the material. Is it clear? It's not that we are cancelling the Casimir effect. We are making it independent. Essentially, we have a Casimir, a constant Casimir effect, and then we would have a modulation of the gravitational effect by changing the source mass behind the shield. This is a trick that so has been used all.
But it's still distance dependent, right? I mean, the Casimir effect is still going to be dependent on how far
yes.
you are from the.
Yes.
Okay. It will dominate by a huge margin, right?
Sorry?
So it's dominant, it's much, it's the
yes,
orders
yes.
of magnitude.
Yes. Yeah, so in fact, this experiment would be done by subtracting and not, so assuming that we know the Casimir effect and looking for deviations. As I will show, this is a difficult, I said at the beginning, and it turned out to be a difficult experiment, so for these reasons, but even more. So, okay, if you put the numbers, we would have addressed this space in the parameter, this region in the parameter space. So micron and alpha about this value. So 5 micron, 10 micron. Okay, this means considering a possible deviation with the Yukawa type potential. And to answer the previous question, what we did was to develop an atom elevator that brings the atom here, you can see at a few micron from surface. And we used an optical tweezer to confine the, to reduce the size of the atomic probe to 4 micron, down to 4 micron. So essentially the probe was done. Here you can see a picture of the source mass in the vacuum system, and these are the strontium atoms, the fluorescence from the strontium atoms trapped in the magnet optical trap. And what we observed when we brought the atoms close to, in this case, to a transparent material, so here there was no Casimir shield. We wanted just to see if we could see an effect near the surface. But what, this is the resonance signal I told you before. So essentially the measurement of the block frequency at a distance of 2 millimeters from the surface. When we got closer, so closer means 700 micron, 200 micron, here, 700, 200, we saw that the signal was going down and the resonance was broadening. So essentially, we found that there was some decoherence effect that was spoiling our signal. And this depends on the distance, as you can see here. So this essentially convinced us to put this experiment in standby. And just now we are trying to characterize the, this material, this surface, to try and correlate the effect that we saw with some property there, maybe some speckle on the surface. Or so we are trying to understand. But this is clearly a strong limitation to the possibility of using this that looked like a very good system. Maybe in practice is too sensitive to other effects.
And it's really on a millimeter scale?
Yeah. So it is too far to be, I mean, any Casimir or it must be some either speckle or some patch effect, yeah, which is typical. We expected that, but we would have been happy to find them maybe a little bit closer to the surface. 1 millimeter is still too far.
This gold you find it at 100 microns from the surface.
This was a, essentially is glass. We had several test surfaces, glass or glass with some coating, anti-reflecting coating. So
if, what if one could come much closer?
Sorry?
What if one could come much closer, say 100 nanometers? Would it be?
100 nanometers?
Yeah.
It would be nice, but with the size of our atomic cloud, it would.
But would, is it sort of more promising regime or less promising?
I think it would be interesting from the scientific point of view. I don't know how we could do that with our system. Because the wavelength of the light that we use for the optical lattice is 500 nanometers. So the separation of the sides is 200 nanometers. So our minimum typical scale is micron.
What would you expect at such short distances? Would you expect that these effects will be much stronger? This?
I don't know what this effect is. I really don't know. If it is speckle, it changes with the distance. If it is speckle of the laser light, but I don't know. Okay, so I should say that there are experiments going on, for example, in France, at CIRT, where they use a different system, but conceptually it's the same idea. So instead of using this modulation of the lattice, they are using a Raman transition to couple different states. But they are still far from the surface. This is done in free space. So they didn't face yet the real problem at the surface. So we will see when they get there. And there have been other proposals for using atoms to probe this kind of effects. And I should say that an experiment was done by the group of Eric Cornell some years ago now, but not using atom interferometry. Essentially, it was measuring the frequency of oscillation of a Bose-Einstein condensate when it was brought close to the surface. So this is a much simpler system that to face problems of patch effects and absorption of rubidium on the... So that to face problems due to the surface. But this is a less sophisticated, I would say, method that proved to be effective in measuring these effects. So, and in the last part of the talk, I know that I put too many material in this presentation, but too much material, but I wanted to give you an overview of, as I said, this is mostly experiments that we have done, but as you will see, these are subjects that are now covered by several groups. And in particular, for example, this last subject with the test of the equivalence principle is, I guess, will be also part of the presentation of Jason Hogan. So when you say equivalence principle test with atoms, essentially you can consider two possibilities. One is atom versus a macroscopic mass. The other is comparing the fall of different atoms. Okay, and both these paths have been already investigated. What we did in this frame was to compare gravity measure with our block oscillation system with a conventional classical gravity gravimeter. Essentially, in the same place we were measuring gravity. As I said, the power of our system is in the fact that we can observe these block oscillations for several seconds. So we could measure gravity with both the system with a relative uncertainty of 100 parts per billion. So this can be interpreted as a test of equivalence principle using this block oscillation system. So for confined atoms compared to a classical dropping object. And also this was interpreted in this paper by Stephen Chu and colleagues that some of you may know about, as a possible measurement of the gravitational redshift. For those of you who know about this paper, this gave rise to a, I would say, strong controversy on the interpretation. But anyway, these kind of experiments were also interpreted in this frame. A recent experiment we have done in this frame was to perform an equivalence principle test using two isotopes of strontium, so dropping a little bit like Galileo from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, dropping two different kind of atoms and checking if they fall in the same way. As I showed before, this has been done with different, not too many, so far mostly with the rubidium atoms, but recently there was a paper comparing rubidium and potassium. I consider this as particularly interesting case because strontium 88 is a boson and it has no spin. It's a zero spin, no nuclear spin in the ground state and no electric magnetic moment. While the strontium is a fermion and it has a nuclear spin of 9.5. So this can be an interesting combination also to investigate possible spin gravity coupling effects. That's the motivation. The experiment, as you can understand, is now measuring gravity with the system I told you with two different isotopes. That's what we did. Here you see the signals that now you know what I'm talking about. And this is the result. So essentially, we got for the Edwards ratio, that is for the difference relative distance difference in the acceleration for the two isotopes, a a number which is at 1 part in 10^7. And also by looking at the broadening of the line as a function of the polarization of the atoms, we can also set an upper value for a possible coupling of the spin with the gravity. And again, in this case, the limit is 1 part in 10^7. So, as I said, I think strontium, even this is specific, but I think for many experiments, strontium is a very good choice. Of course, for optical clocks, this is clear. I wanted to mention that also people in Stanford here proposed strontium as the right atom to develop a new detector for gravitational waves. And I think, again, this will be part of the presentation of Jason Hogan. And so one can think in the future of using a system for transportable strontium apparatus for a possible space mission where you would be able to combine an atom interferometer, an advanced optical clock, and maybe also a gravitational wave detector. So I think this would be really a fascinating probe for general relativity for a space mission. Okay, for if you're interested in gravitational wave detection with atom interferometry, you can look at this special issue that was published a couple of years ago. I skipped this because I know that now it's too much. Maybe I just want to draw your attention to this paper we published on the possibility of testing the muonic anomaly using precise measurement of H over M. So, looking for new physics beyond the standard model using, again, atom interferometry. Okay, this is a list of possible things. I touched part of them, but there are more than I could present you in this time. And if you're interested in atom interferometry, I want to suggest that you look at this book that should be published soon with the proceedings of the Varenna School that we organized with Mark Asevich last year. And I would like to finish by acknowledging the people of my group that performed the work that I presented to you today and supporting funding institutions. And thank you for your attention. I'm in time. Maybe I was fast, but.
has there been searches for temporal variation of the big G constant? And is this maybe a good system to do sort of like some sort of continuous?
No. I mean, it would be nice, but what we are doing there is to measure the value.
Right.
And to measure the value, you must know the mass. If you wanted to look for a variation of big G, then you are in competition with measurement done by lunar laser ranging, where you, since you don't, in that case, you don't need the value, but you just look at the variation, and that can be extremely more sensitive. The limit is passing 10^13 at the moment. So I think there is no way of competing on that.
Yeah.
It would be nice, but the numbers are in favor.
I didn't get this last idea. The muon, the muonic atom you want to drop, or
no? You know that there is this disagreement for the muon anomaly between theory and experiments.
G minus two, or there are several anomalies.
So sorry,
several.
G minus two.
There is like muon redshift anomaly, hydrogen, and G minus two disagreement. This. So
yes.
Aware
so I'm talking about the magnetic moment anomaly.
Yes.
And so this, as far as I understand, is considered as a possible path to look for new physics.
Sure.
Now, you could think of doing the same with the electromagnetic moment, but you lose because of the mass ratio, factor of 10^4. So in some model, you will lose as the square of the mass ratio. Now, in this paper, we just show that it's just an update on the situation. If you take the present experimental situation with the recent experiment that was done measuring the electron mass, Klaus-Blaum, So if you take
it's
this...
it's just atomic recoil you're talking
yes.
about, that together with alpha. Right?
Exactly,
okay, okay,
yeah.
Okay. That's... I was thinking that you are going to do something with muons.
No.
Okay.
It's the opposite. It's to show that essentially, using the electron and going through a better measurement of alpha, that is H over M, you are close to being the same in some model.
It's still limited by atomic recoil. Right?
Yes,
yeah.
But we are not far. That's the observation. Because until now, there was also a limit in the knowledge of the electron mass. But this recent measurement improved by a factor of 13. So now that's not the limit. So this becomes realistic. That's the message.
I didn't notice any temperature systematic on your big G measurement or why. How stable is your lab? Any change in temperature?
Yes.
Change, and is that even correlated with the barometric pressure, which is a sizable correction?
You're right. So this was an initial investment in terms of money that I did in my lab. So the temperature stability is about 0.1 degrees. And the temperature we kept under control, the humidity is kept under control. So it was controlled then. You can always be wrong, but this was. And most many this experiment was done in Florence, in the university. But we interacted quite a lot with our colleagues at INRIM, the Italian Meteorological Institute. So, for example, the mass characterization was done by them, the weighting was done with their balance, considering the buoyancy and the. We try to do things right.
There's been some previous really precise experiments searching for these spin gravity couplings. Blaine, I believe, has two of the best results with looking at perception.
Yeah, and
of
also yes.
And looking at the spin polarized torsion pendulum. And so I remember the most recent sort of spin gravity tests using dropped atoms that I know of in the literature were far less sensitive than the torsion pendulum and spin precession experiments. I didn't catch how did the...
Which experiment are you referring to?
I think there was an experiment by Ted Hinch's group some years ago dropping Rubidium atoms.
Could you show your result with the spin gravity?
Yeah, how does that... I guess how does it compare to the spin precession and torsion pendulum experiments?
So the experiment you are quoting about from
next
Ted Hinch...
Next one.
In fact, what they were doing was to use two different hyperfine states. So,
yeah.
Most of these cases, I think the interpretation is model dependent. So, what I like in this experiment is that it's, in my opinion, is quite I wouldn't say model independent, but you have one particle which has no spin, zero, and the other which has a spin. So, since I think that. There is some difficulty in understanding the interpretation. From an experimental point of view, to me, it's at least experimental is a good choice.
It's a different parameterization. Usually, what you're referring to, usually people talk about the coupling of S dot G. Then here, as you can see, Z entering.
Yes.
So it's a different thing.
Okay.
I have to keep some time, right? So. What I suggest we do, we take a 10-minute break, okay, because we are late.
Let's do 20 minutes.
No, but we have to keep on time for lunch, right, because they are going to serve us at a certain
we time. We can talk to the lunch people and postpone the lunch by 15 minutes.
Okay, so let's be back at 11:10, okay?
Oh,
this will take our right?